Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear the annual Winthrop and Francis Lane Foundation lecture presented each year by the Creighton University School of Law. The guest speaker will be the Honorable Dragoljub Popovic, a member of the European Court of Human Rights. His topic will be judicial discretion in the jurisprudence of the European Court of Human Rights. This program is recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, March 5th, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Eric Ciappinelli, Dean of the Creighton University School of Law.
This year, the 2009 Lane Foundation Lecture is going to be given by a judge of one of the most important international courts. I think he will be speaking from here. He may well be more comfortable speaking from the bench. If you want to pronounce some opinions, you could just go on up there and do that. It would be okay. He studied law at the University of Belgrade. He's been a professor of law, an academic. He's been a private attorney. He's also been in the diplomatic service. He has served his country as ambassador from Serbia and Montenegro to Switzerland. He is a prolific scholar. He's got 7 books to his credit, any number of articles. For the last 4 years, he has been a judge on the European Court of Human Rights. But would you please join me in welcoming the Honorable Dragoljub Popovic. Thank you.
Thank you for the introduction, and I'm glad to be here, and I'm grateful to the Lane Foundation, to Dean Ciappinelli, and last but not least, to Professor Morse, Edward Morse, who was the spiritus movens, as well as the spiritus agens of the whole enterprise of bringing me here. The topic of this lecture concerns the European Court of Human Rights, which is an international court of law. And let me make just 2 small introductory remarks before I start the lecture. The first one concerns the court, which is going to be hereinafter referred to as the court. That's the European Court of Human Rights, which is composed of 47 judges of all member states of the Council of Europe that ratified the European Convention on Human Rights of 1950. The convention will be referred to as convention. That was my first remark. My second remark is that the provisions of the convention lack definitions and contain large formulas, thus representing a challenge for judicial creativity. The question, the topic of this lecture is whether the judicial activism prevailed over the self-restraint in the jurisprudence of the European Court of Human Rights. Well, to start the lecture, the court's judgments have a binding character, and the sentiments of judges are strongly in favor of stability of the court's case law. At the same time, a comprehensive doctrine of stare decisis within the court's jurisprudence does not exist at all. However, the court made its position clear in the case Bird versus United Kingdom. It's a case of 2001, and the judgment is not published, expressing the view that it was in the interest of legal certainty, foreseeability, and equality before the law that the court should not depart from its own precedents without good reasons. The binding force of precedent, although adopted and followed by the court, hasn't been an obstacle to the court's creativity or an impediment to the development of the court's case law. The court is entitled to interpret the convention, but also to recommend and prescribe measures of redress for violations of human rights. Judicial activism played a role in all 3 domains, in interpreting, recommending, and, well, ordering or prescribing. The court's power to interpret the convention is laid down by the text of the letter, It has been mentioned expressis verbis in Article 30 of the Convention, but it can also well be construed from Article 19, by which the Court has actually been instituted. The Court has created the so-called autonomous concepts while interpreting the Convention. It also introduced evolutive interpretation, innovative interpretation, and last but not least, on some occasions, the Court interpreted the Convention contrary to the intention of its drafters. All those techniques witness the Court's creativity and judicial discretion. Autonomous concepts are specific tools of legal interpretation often used by the Court. Autonomous concepts are, I quote, technical terms that are employed in legal sources and are invested with special, non-ordinary meaning, unquote. The author of this definition, George Letsas, has submitted the notion of autonomous concepts to thorough analysis. He discussed the issue of relations of autonomous concepts to the judicial discretion. His conclusion was that judges must inevitably make choices when applying the Convention. Even if judges were to stick to what might be considered ordinary meanings of certain concepts, they would be exercising a choice. For that reason, Letsas rejects the reproach to the judges based on the assumption that by introducing autonomous concepts, they are making new law. They would have made it anyway because of the inevitability of choice while interpreting the Convention. What autonomous concepts really are can be illustrated by some examples. Article 6, paragraph 1 of the Convention guarantees the right to a fair trial to anyone, I quote, in the determination of his civil rights and obligations, unquote. The notion of civil rights and obligations turned out to be much less clear in terms of court's interpretation than one might think at first glance. The court took a stand on the issue for the first time in Ringeisen case. It was a case against Austria, a case of 1971. A businessman was speculating with real estate in Austria, and doing business he had to address administrative bodies in the course of proceedings at the domestic level. Therefore, the question was before the court whether Article 6.1 could come into play, or in other words, whether the case concerned civil rights and obligations at all. The court's answer was that civil rights and obligations in respect of Article 6.1 of the Convention were to be understood in the same way as in private law. If the nature of a legal issue was a private law one, Article 6.1 of the Convention could apply, even if it had been a matter of an administrative dispute at the national level of jurisdiction. The court was faced again with the same issue of defining the notion of civil rights and obligations in the Pellegrin case. It's a case of 1999. An engineer was recruited for the French government service providing support to West African states. He could not get the post because medical examinations found him unfit for job in the climate circumstances existing in Africa. The court's ruling was that Article 6.1 could not apply to cases involving civil servants because those had special bonds of loyalty to the sovereign power. Their service included by itself the exercise of the sovereign power, and for that reason, their cases did not concern civil rights and obligations. The ruling in Pellegrin heralded the principle of revisiting previous jurisprudence and introduced a new criterion of application of Article 6 of the Convention. It remained for years to be the leading case in that field, and it was followed by the judges of the court. Another turning point came with a Finnish case. In Vilho Eskelinen and others versus Finland, a case of 2007, the Grand Chamber of the court departed from the rule in Pellegrin. In the Finnish case, a group of policemen had complained at the domestic level of the payment of their salaries. The rule in Pellegrin spoke most clearly against their claim, for they were civil servants, and they had indeed, by virtue of their service, rather special bonds to the exercise of the national sovereignty. The Grand Chamber decided to depart from the previous ruling. Its holding was that the rule in Pellegrin excluding application of Article 6.1 of the Convention was much too wide. In the Grand Chamber's view, as expressed in Eskelinen, a contracting state to the Convention was allowed to exclude protection of Article 6.1 of the Convention in certain classes of actions of civil servants at the domestic level. But when doing so, a contracting state is submitted to two conditions. The first is that such exclusion of protection must find grounds in the national legislation, and the second, that it is justified. The latter is by all means subject to the court's scrutiny. The evolutive interpretation, also known as a living instrument approach of the court, is also an example of judicial discretion. This approach appeared for the first time in Tyrer versus United Kingdom. It was a case of 1978. The issue was whether corporal punishment of juveniles amounted to a degrading punishment in terms of Article 3 of the Convention. The events took place in the Isle of Man, one of the Channel Islands belonging to the British Crown. A schoolboy had taken some bottles of beer to his school and was afterwards punished by a court of law to birching, carried out at a police station. The punishment was prescribed by law. The Attorney General of the Isle of Man submitted to the court that corporal punishments of juveniles did not outrage public opinion of the little island. The court stated in the judgment that the convention was a living instrument and that it had to be interpreted in the light of the present-day conditions. It also stated that its judgment was influenced, I quote, by the developments and commonly accepted standards in the penal policy of the member states of the Council of Europe, unquote. The court found a violation of Article 3 of the Convention in this case, for in the court's view, the corporal punishment institutionalized assault on a person's dignity and physical integrity. The idea was that as most of the countries have rejected an old practice, it could by no means be upheld by the court. Social developments that have occurred thus influenced court's rulings and its interpretation of the convention, a living instrument susceptible of going hand in hand with legal and social developments in European countries. The evolutive interpretation as a method can also be well exposed if we take the example of the Dudgeon case. It's a case of 1981. The issue was whether the legislation of Northern Ireland prohibiting male homosexual practices between consenting adults was in accordance with Article 8 of the Convention, providing protection of private life. The evolutive interpretation and the living instrument approach were clearly visible in the judgment. The court recalled the increased tolerance of homosexual behavior in the majority of member states of the Council of Europe, existing at the moment of giving the judgment, compared to the one of the era when the legislation was enacted. The notion of private life has therefore been considerably altered, and as a matter of fact, the court invalidated an old-style piece of legislation. Evolutive interpretation is such a method in which the court takes into consideration the developments of social and legal concepts that occur in Europe in order to find grounds for attaching certain meanings to the terms of the convention. The court's discretion is based on such developments and evolution of ideas, which lead the court to make turning points in its case law. It has been remarked that the evolutive interpretation could not permit the judicial creation of new rights and freedoms not already protected by the text of the convention. This might be considered true, but the value of the remark seems to be primarily semantic. The limited scope of the remark becomes obvious if we consider the substance of both examples of evolutive interpretation discussed here. If corporal punishment of juveniles was not permitted anymore, there was no need to call it a new right under the convention. It actually was such. The same applies to the second example. If homosexuals are allowed to their practices that have been previously forbidden, there is indeed a new right for a whole class of persons. It doesn't matter whether it should be given the rank of a special right under the convention. A strict opinion says, however, that no other rights but those granted by the convention text could be recognized by the court. Those who are ready to agree to this might be puzzled by the Golder case. It was a case of 1975 against the United Kingdom. Some scholars claim that it was one of the most important cases in the court's history. The applicant in Golder was a person serving a prison sentence who had been refused possibility of contacting a counsel with a view to bringing an action on libel against a prison officer. The legal question was whether Article 6 of the Convention could apply to the case. The problem in Golder was the wording of Article 6 of the Convention. It provides on the rights of a person who is already before a court of justice. Could it be construed in such a way as to provide on access to justice as such? The court's answer to this question was in the affirmative. With the support in the law of international treaties and their interpretation, the court found that the wording of Article 6 was susceptible of including the access to court within the scope of protection of Article 6. The right of access to court, although unknown in the Convention text, has become a part of the European human rights law ever since. This can easily be proved if one is to consult respective manuals on the subject. They speak of the right of access to court as one of those recognized by the Convention. The court's judgment in Golder shows the capacity of the court to read into the text of the Convention a certain meaning or substance which is lacking in its wording. The degree of court's creativity is therefore quite significant, and the final outcome of its discretion was indeed the creation of a new right, fairly recognized by the doctrine as well as the court's own jurisprudence. It could be claimed, however, that the court in Golder did not transgress the intention of the drafters of the Convention text. It found the text of Article 6 neutral towards the question of a more extensive meaning of the concept of the right to a fair trial, so as to include the access to court. At this point, we come to the question whether the court could, by its interpretation of the provisions of the Convention, run counter of the intention of its drafters. The court was also inclined to recognize certain rights that the drafters of the Convention did not want to grant. That is what happened in the British closed shop case. It's a case of 1981, and it is known as Young, Jameson, Webster versus United Kingdom. Article 11 of the Convention was at stake, granting freedom of assembly and association. The issue was whether an employer was entitled to demand that all employees of a certain class should be members of the same trade union. The applicants in the British closed shop case were British Rail employees who did not want to join a trade union because of their disagreement with its political attitudes and aims. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights of the United Nations of 1948, which served in many aspects as a model for the Convention, provides in its Article 20, Paragraph 2, on a liberty not to be compelled to enter into the closed shop system. The provision of Article 20 of the Universal Declaration was discussed among the drafters of the Convention, who did not want to include such a provision in the text. The court was not willing, in Young, James, and Webster, to consider the intentions of the drafters of the Convention to be decisive, although they were clearly recorded in the preparatory works. The court rather interpreted the substance of the right recognized by Article 11 of the Convention. It held that construing Article 11 so as to permit, I quote, a compulsion in the field of trade union membership would strike at the very substance of the freedom it was designed to guarantee, unquote. The purpose of the Convention prevailed over the words. The court's interpretation of the Convention text did not take into account the intention of the drafters, but rather favored the more profound need to accord protection of human rights. The court's power to interpret the Convention has thus probably reached its highest point, and the court's creativity and judicial discretion their respective limits. The court's power to recommend measures of redress for violations of human rights emerged in the court's jurisprudence without being envisaged by the Convention text. It proved to be sufficiently effective. This power proved to be sufficiently effective because of the court's undisputed authority. When treating the power to recommend measures of redress as exercised by the court, one should distinguish recommending an individual measure of redress from the one of recommending general measures. As far as the recommendation of an individual measure of redress by the court is concerned, the story begins with the recommendation of the Committee of Ministers of the 19th of January 2000. The Committee of Ministers is a body of the Council of Europe which is competent for the enforcement, for supervising the enforcement of the judgments of the court. The Committee of Ministers tackled the problem arising in those cases in which there was a lack of appropriate national legislation. For such cases, the Committee of Ministers suggested that the re-examination or reopening of proceedings at the domestic level, following judgments of the court. The leading case in respect of recommending an individual measure was Gençel versus Turkey, a case of 2003. The judgment is not published. The applicant was sentenced by a state security court. State security courts in Turkey should not be confused with military courts. The latter are competent to try army and navy officers, whereas the former try civilians for the offenses against state security. The bench of the state security court included military judges, being army officers submitted to the military discipline and chain of command. The court's view was that such a composition of the bench could not satisfy requirements of Article 6 of the Convention granting a right to a fair trial. The court therefore recommended that the applicant should be allowed a new trial before a court that should fulfill the Convention requirements. The recommendation made by a chamber of the court in Gençel was repeated by the Grand Chamber in another Turkish case. That was in Öcalan versus Turkey, the case of 2005. The problem in Öcalan was exactly the same as the one in the former case mentioned above. It concerned the presence of military judges on the bench. The Grand Chamber held that, I quote, the most appropriate form of redress would be for the applicant to be given a retrial without delay if he or she so requests, unquote. In many other Turkish cases of the same class, the recommendation was repeated. The Turkish government lost in a good number of disputes at the European level, which made it introduce a bill to the parliament at home in order to achieve the reform of the system of the state security courts. Military judges do not sit at the bench of such courts anymore. The so-called Gençel-Öcalan clause, inserted into judgments intended to produce effects in particular cases, has thus managed to achieve a broader effect. On certain occasions, the court ventured to recommend general measures of redress to the respondent states. For instance, if a violation of the convention resulted from particular domestic legislation or from the absence of legislation, the respondent state has either to amend the legislation or introduce new laws. The practice of the court in this respect dates back to the 90s of the last century. In Botazzi versus Italy, a case of 1999, it was noted in the judgment that the court had already rendered 65 judgments against Italy based on the sets of facts of the same kind. The issue in all Italian cases matching Botazzi was the length of proceedings before the courts of law at the domestic level. Therefore, the court's holding was that the problem amounted to a continuous situation of violation of human rights, which remained unresolved, and in which the parties to the proceedings did not have an effective domestic remedy at their disposal. The court recommended the respondent state to find a solution to the problem. The Italian government followed the court's recommendation. A respective bill was introduced to the parliament, and less than 2 years after the judgment had been rendered in Botazzi, a piece of legislation was adopted introducing a domestic remedy in cases of extensive length of proceedings. In another case, the court used a more specific wording and a clearer formula to recommend a general measure. It was in Skotsarian Junta versus Italy, a case of the year 2000, that the court reiterated the freedom of choice of such measures of redress granted to the contracting states to the convention. At the same time, the court stressed the obligation of the respondent state to introduce general measures in order to remedy the existing situation of violation of human rights. The issue in Skotsarian Junta was the custody of children and the circumstances of conferring children to institutions of social care that did not meet the requirements of Article 8 of the Convention. The respondent state could not be considered to have complied with the judgment by a payment of a sum of money in just satisfaction to a certain party, but indeed only after having introduced measures to remedy the problem at stake in general. General measures recommended remain under the court's scrutiny. This was made clear in the Sadovich case. It was a case of the year 2006. The applicant had been sentenced in absentia for murder in Italy. Several years later, he was apprehended in Germany. The German authorities refused to extradite the applicant to Italy on the grounds that the Italian law did not offer sufficient guarantees for a retrial of a person sentenced in absentia. A chamber of the court rendered judgment in November 2004, holding that there was a violation of Article 6 of the Convention granting the right to a fair trial. At the request of the Italian government, the case was referred to the Grand Chamber. The respondent government claimed before the Grand Chamber to have fulfilled the recommendation of the court's chamber. Former Article 175 of the Criminal Procedure Code of Italy had meanwhile been amended by a special piece of legislation adopted in April 2005. The Grand Chamber of the Court rendered its judgment on the case in March 2006. Its main finding was that it was too early to estimate the scope and efficiency of the statutory amendment of April 2005, because there still was no jurisprudence of the Cassation Court of Italy on the subject. A mere adoption of a general measure by enacting a statute could not prove that a respondent state complied with the recommendation. The Grand Chamber therefore confirmed the Chamber judgment on the case and also found a violation of Article 6 of the Convention. The court has the power to afford just satisfaction as a measure of redress for a violation of the Convention committed. The court imposes on the respondent state a legal obligation to put an end to the violation of human rights and make reparation of its consequences. The respondent state must do it in such a way as to restore, as far as possible, the situation existing before the violation. As the respondents are sovereign states, they are allowed to choose the mode of redress, but the court has started limiting their powers on certain occasions. The court is entitled by Article 41 of the Convention, when finding a violation of human rights, to afford just satisfaction to the injured party. This is, however, subject to certain requirements. The court has the power to award just satisfaction to the extent that full reparation is not available under the domestic law. The court does not specify the remedy, and it awards just satisfaction only in the presence of a causal link between the violation of the Convention and the injury the applicant complains of. The court, however, usually affords a sum of money in just satisfaction, and the respondent government cannot escape its obligation in any other way but by the payment of the sum afforded to the applicant. The clause of just satisfaction takes place in the operative parts of the court's judgments, which sufficiently prove its prescriptive character. Although binding, the judgments of the court are basically declarative. They are prescriptive only insofar as they afford just satisfaction. But the court has, however, gone beyond this. It was a rather peculiar situation which made the court stick to the judicial discretion or activism in order to prescribe an individual measure of redress to a respondent state. The case was a Georgian one. It concerned the specific character of the political and social situation in that country. That was the case Asanidze versus Georgia of the year 2004. The applicant was a man who had been detained in the province of Ajaria, which at the time did not want to fully recognize the authority of the central government of Georgia. Ajaria should not be confused with the Georgian breakaway province of Abkhazia, for the former has meanwhile made a compromise with the central government and remains a part of the state of Georgia. As the province hasn't got a standing under international law, the application was lodged against Georgia, or filed, to put it in your way. The court's holding was that the detention of the applicant was arbitrary and constituted a violation of Article 5 of the Convention. Affording just satisfaction in terms of money could not have produced effect because the arbitrary detention would have continued. The dilemma was therefore either to issue a formal judgment devoid of effect or pursue the path of judicial activism in order to put an end to violations of human rights. In Asanidze, the court ordered, I quote, that the respondent state must secure the applicant's release at the earliest possible date, unquote. A remark should be made here that the court's prescription of a measure was addressed to the central government of Georgia, who was the respondent in the case. The central government did not dispose of a full control of the territory of Ajaria, and therefore was not in a position to comply with the measure prescribed. However, the authority of the court's judgment was such as to produce effect, and the Ajarian authorities complied with the court's ruling. The court follows this path more often in other cases in which it orders the respondent government to enforce a decision taken at the domestic level so that it puts an end to violations of human rights. Prescribing enforcement of a domestic judgment or decision can be illustrated, for instance, by the cases Terem Limited, Chechetkin and Olius versus Ukraine, or, for instance, Ilich versus Serbia. Both judgments are not published. The Ukrainian case is the one of 2005 and the Serbian one of 2007. In the Ukrainian case, the issue was an irregular seizure of the applicant's property in tax proceedings. It was prescribed to the respondent government to pay to the applicant the sum awarded by the domestic courts of law. In the Serbian case, the eviction of a tenant from the applicant's flat was at stake. The respondent government was prescribed to comply with a decision rendered in the first instance at the domestic level that had meanwhile become final but remained unexecuted. The court ventured to prescribe general measures, to order general measures of redress in the operative parts of its respective judgments in two Polish cases. The judgments rendered belong to the so-called pilot judgments. In the pilot judgments, the court is entitled, on the grounds of two recommendations of the Committee of Ministers, to either recommend or prescribe a remedy to a systemic problem leading to violations of human rights at the domestic level. The two cases against Poland were Broniowski and Hutenczapska. In Broniowski, the issue was indemnifying of repatriated persons that settled in Poland immediately after World War II for their property left beyond new Polish frontiers in the regions they had moved from. In Hutenczapska, the issue was striking of a balance between landlords and tenants in the situation of shortage of apartments. In both cases, the court found systemic deficiencies in the functioning of domestic legal order and prescribed the respondent state to introduce remedies in the form of general measures. The respondent state was, however, free to choose the mode and form of those. Recently, the court has gone rather far limiting member states' sovereign powers. In the case of L versus Lithuania, the court went so far as to order to the respondent state to pass a piece of legislation within a specified period. The judgment is not published. It's a case of 2007. The issue was changing of sex, which is provided for by Article 227, Section 1 of the Civil Code of Lithuania of 2001 as a right of each and every citizen of the country. The respective provision of the Civil Code envisages, however, that a piece of secondary legislation would provide on conditions and procedure of gender reassignment. The applicant filed the application with the court without addressing national authorities at all. The court found it would have been useless because of the absence of the secondary legislation on the subject envisaged by the Civil Code. The application was declared admissible. Furthermore, a violation of Article 8 of the Convention was found. The respondent state was prescribed, I quote, to pass the required subsidiary legislation on gender reassignment of transsexuals within 3 months of the present judgment becoming final, unquote. However, the court left some room for action to the respondent state because the operative part of the judgment provided that the respondent state was to pay a certain sum of money in case it failed to pass the piece of legislation prescribed. One can imagine the complications of parliamentary procedure to adopt any sort of act within a given period of time. The court's prescription was rather far-reaching in that respect. I sat on the bench in this case, and along with my Swedish colleague, Mrs. Fura Sandström, I was a dissenter. To my mind, the application should have been declared inadmissible for non-exhaustion of domestic remedies. During the oral hearing, the respondent government had produced a ruling of the Constitutional Court of Lithuania, proving that the position of that court was favorable to judges construing of statutes in the way to satisfy social needs. The judges at the domestic level, for the most part, did not venture to go beyond literal interpretation of the civil code. However, they should have been given an opportunity to issue a ruling before the application was lodged in Strasbourg. My Swedish colleague objected in her separate dissenting opinion that the court had acted ultra vires in this case. I hereby declare I agree with her in spite of being basically favorable to the judicial discretion of the court. To my mind, the self-restraint should have prevailed in this particular case. Now to turn to the judicial self-restraint, the most important tool of judicial self-restraint of the court is the margin of appreciation of contracting states. The court tends to grant to the contracting states a margin of appreciation as to what local circumstances and public order require. Margins of appreciation represent, I quote, outer limits of schemes of protection which are acceptable to the convention, unquote. Therefore, the court does not interfere with actions that are within the margin of appreciation. The court's role has always been considered subsidiary, leaving to the authorities of the member states of the convention enough room to estimate the facts, for they are better placed to do so. The court only looks after the protection of human rights within the limits posed by the convention. The court ruled on the margin of appreciation in one of its early judgments. It was the Handyside case of 1976. A court of law in the United Kingdom ordered seizure and the ban of a school book because of its obscene contents. The applicant invoked the freedom of expression granted by Article 10 of the Convention. The court ruled that such freedom included distributing information that might offend, shock, or disturb, but found, however, no violation of that provision. The court's decision was founded on the margin of appreciation of a member state to the Convention. The court's role was subsidiary, and the court was not to intervene with the appreciation made by authorities at the domestic level so far as to define what is and what is not obscene. Such an attitude of the court is considered to find grounds in the very nature of the convention. In another British case, Articles 5 and 6 of the convention were at issue. The case concerned the continued compulsory confinement in a special secure psychiatric hospital of a mental patient declared fit for transfer to an ordinary psychiatric hospital. The access to justice of such a person was at stake. The applicant had access to court at the domestic level, only to be told that his actions were barred by operation of law. The court's holding was that the right to access to justice was not absolute. It could be subject to certain requirements, and the contracting states of the convention should enjoy a margin of appreciation imposing those in their legal systems. In both cases mentioned above, the court was willing to grant a margin of appreciation to a member state, and it consequently opted for decisions inspired by self-restraint. There were cases in which the court was less favorable to that method. That is what happened in Still and Morris versus United Kingdom, a case of 2005. London ecologists of the Greenpeace were campaigning against visiting McDonald's restaurants. They alleged the company was responsible for hunger in the third world and depriving of property of the small owners as well as of the fertile land belonging to tribes in countries where tribal life and organization still exist. The company sued the London Greenpeace branch for libel. The plaintiff in the domestic proceedings is liable to pay attorney's fees, but he or she is entitled to demand legal aid from the court. However, the plaintiff in this particular case could not be granted legal aid because it was excluded in England and Wales in actions for libel. The plaintiffs at the domestic level lodged an application with the court invoking Article 6 and complaining of an alleged violation of their right to a fair trial. The court confirmed the rule according to which the member states were entitled to provide on requirements for access to justice, the rule in Ashington. The court was of opinion that the company should be able to prove the truth and enjoy protection of its prestige. However, the court held that such remedies granted by a national legal order could by no means consist of refusing legal aid to a party to the proceedings confronted with a rich and influential company involved worldwide in the trade. The idea of fairness and striking a balance between parties in domestic proceedings thus prevailed over the self-restraint. The court found a violation of Article 6 on the grounds that a certain legal provision actually ran counter of the protection of human rights under the Convention. In some other cases, the margin of appreciation had to be interpreted in respect of the whole social and political situation of a member state. An example of this kind can be found in Yumak and Sadak versus Turkey, a case of 2008. The case concerned a constitutional issue. The electoral threshold of 10% of votes in the elections at the national level for a list to obtain parliamentary seats within the proportional system was at stake. Small parties complained they could not achieve parliamentary representation because of the threshold. The court did not find a violation. It should be noted that a review of comparative law of the member states on the issue showed that such a high threshold as in Turkey existed nowhere in Europe. The second highest was the one of Liechtenstein, amounting to 8%. It seemed to me that the margin of appreciation in this case well served the purpose. Turkey is a country with a wide range of problems. Its political system remains unstable. And the margin of appreciation was therefore rather helpful, although the judges were not unanimous on the issue whether that matter should apply to the case or not. In Yumak and Sadak, as well as in many other cases, the court's holding was based on a comparative law research prepared by a special service of the court's registry. It should be noted that the court seeks inspiration in that respect both from the member states of the Council of Europe and from other countries, such as the United States, Canada, or South Africa, for instance. Handling the comparative law proved to be a reason for restricting the margin of appreciation on certain occasions, as it was in the Goodwin case, a case against the United Kingdom of the year 2002. The applicant in that case was a person registered at birth as male who underwent gender reassignment surgery. She complained of the lack of legal recognition of her change of sex. The court found a violation of Article 8 of the Convention on the grounds that, I quote, the respondent government could no longer claim that the matter fell within their margin of appreciation, save as regards the appropriate means of achieving recognition of the right protected under the Convention, unquote. The court thus narrowed the scope of the margin of appreciation being inspired by the evolution on the world level. The margin of appreciation proves to be an important tool of the court's methodology. It has been observed on the one hand that the doctrine of margin of appreciation should be handled with care, for otherwise the court were to lose its element of independent control of national election. There were, on the other hand, critics among scholars of a certain tendency of the court that allegedly tried to stick to the doctrine of margin of appreciation in order to avoid tackling sensitive social issues. The characteristic features of the doctrine, as well as its limits, are, however, still to be made more precise. Throughout its 50 years of history, the court has managed to achieve a considerable degree of creativity in its jurisprudence. By developing the European law of human rights, the court has been able to put aside short-sighted nationalisms and indeed exercise an independent control of national action. The methods of the court's jurisprudence while developing the provisions of the Convention and giving those breaths of life were basically twofold. The court has been using judicial activism along with the self-restraint. The two basic approaches go in parallel to some extent. Dedicated defenders of judicial activism fairly admit the necessity of a certain convergence of the two opposed methods of judicial approaches, of judicial approach to cases. However, it occurs to me that the analysis of the court's jurisprudence reveals the fact that judicial activism as a method prevailed over the self-restraint. Prevailing of judicial activism is proved by developing of a wide range of various techniques as its tools, such as the evolutive interpretation, innovative interpretation, interpretation contrary to the drafter's intentions, and last but not least, autonomous concepts often used by the court. A limited legislative ability in the international context that the court functions within justifies to some extent its more activist approach. The context of the court's work seems to be different, at least at first sight, if compared to the situation existing in the United States, where, I quote, the federal judiciary has surrounded itself with an elaborate system of institutional devices of self-restraint, unquote. It should nevertheless be added that, I quote again, the philosophy of living constitution continues to predominate in the courts and in the law schools in the United States, unquote. On the one hand, techniques of judicial activism followed by the European Court of Human Rights were better adapted to the evolution of the court's provisions susceptible to development than the opposite method of self-restraint. On the other hand, the most important technique of judicial self-restraint, being the doctrine of margin of appreciation, remained less developed from a doctrinal standpoint. Moreover, it served on certain occasions, such as achieving political fairness within a constitutional system, for instance, to fulfill those tasks the court was on other occasions to reach by the other method. And to close this lecture, I feel bound to underline that my only task was to display the current state of the court's jurisprudence. It occurs to me that the two methods are not equal. Judicial activism has prevailed over the self-restraint. Any estimation of the displayed fact of preponderance of judicial activism within the court's jurisprudence goes beyond my task. Whether such preponderance is good or bad, valuable or devoid of value, whether it deserves appraisal or calls for criticism, are questions that remain open. It is not for those who have participated in a process to judge its achievements. And I'm deeply grateful to you for your patience.
You've been listening to a program from the Creighton University Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard the annual Winthrop and Francis Lane Foundation Lecture, presented each year by the Creighton University School of Law. The speaker was the Honorable Dragolia Popovich, a member of the European Court of Human Rights. His topic was Judicial Discretion in the Jurisprudence of the European Court of Human Rights. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, March 5, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.